The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we're back finally from here, there, and everywhere. I actually was with you last week, but of all your world travel over the last month, is Vegas really the capstone?
It's not necessarily the highlight of the trip in terms of a place to visit. Frankly, Zurich, New York, Jerusalem, these are places that I would prefer to either spend more time on, either leisurely or otherwise.
They're not quite Sin City like Vegas truly is.
Exactly, but I would say we met with some extraordinary people in Vegas, and we just wanted to share some of the questions that came up in that conference, but also as I traveled to the Middle East and met with different people, when they knew what I did and who I was, questions that they asked. Also in New York, when we met with clients there, as well as Zurich, sort of a repeating of the same themes and ideas, it's obvious that there's some things on people's minds.
Well, not everyone's. Okay. Some people are watching CNBC and thinking that we're coming out of the recession and things are fine. The people who actually pay money to hear speakers like you and some of the others that were there, those people are thinking people. And there's a lot of concerned questions right now, very well informed. Concerned questions. We can maybe look at those later.
Essentially, Kevin, if you shrunk it down, it's just that prices in the marketplace reflect all available knowledge.
Right.
And so there is this supposed efficiency where what you see is what you get. If the Dow is priced at 10,000,
then it must be the price
and
that's
accurate. It should be at 10,000.
I see.
If the price of gold is 1,200, it has priced in all available knowledge, whether that is future deflation, future inflation. The market is somehow this sort of all-knowing sage. It's the collective minds of the world all voting. The result is the truth.
Is that a hypothesis that works?
Well, I think it's broken. We've proven that it's broken over the last two or three years, but it's still operative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how accurately and predictively is the bond market pricing in, for instance, credit quality changes? We have the mortgage-backed securities market, the municipal bond market, and the treasuries market.
Municipal bonds. I mean, right now, the premiums on municipal bonds are extremely low. So the market must obviously be saying that they're safe.
Well, and our reasons for concern were first in the mortgage-backed securities market. This is the market that securitizes and distributes mortgage paper in bundles to various investors around the world. Now, they don't distribute it to various investors around the world. The only person buying mortgage-backed securities of late has been the Fed, the largest purchaser of mortgage-backed securities in the 2009 to 2010 period. But, you know, the effect of those purchases has been a preservation of stability, a prevention, if you will, Kevin, of an unwinding of excess speculation in that sector. Now, excess speculation specifically in the housing sector during that 2003 to 2006 period when that paper was being put together, bundled, securitized, and sold. So what's happened in effect, Kevin, is that these massive purchases of mortgage-backed securities have grossly overpriced those securities and suppressed yields. Yields that would otherwise herald significant risk in the marketplace.
Well, let's just look at interest rates. Interest rates are a measure of risk. The higher the interest rates, the higher the possibility of a default.
The difference between 30-year agency mortgage-backed securities, so we're talking Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper essentially, and 10-year treasuries was 2% or 200 basis points in the context of the last credit swoon of 2008. Now, after Fed buying of treasuries sitting on the Fed balance sheet, it stands at 75 basis points, or just under 1%.
So very tight.
Yeah. And so in spite of a 25 to 50% sell-off in real estate and the uncovering of poor lending practices in both the subprime and prime markets, and now with wealthy homeowners initiating, as we talked about a few weeks ago, Kevin, strategic defaults.
Right, quote-unquote, where they don't have to default, but they're underwater, so they just walk away is a business decision.
And then that's 12% of current foreclosures. And, of course, those less economically fortunate walking away from homes at record rates. In addition, we've got shadow inventories. You know, just coming back from Vegas, there's over 100,000 homes that are off the market but have been defaulted on, and they're being held on the balance sheets of banks so as not to further depress the market.
And can you imagine that, David? 100,000 homes coming to market that have been foreclosed on, or they're not making payments. Well, no, those have been foreclosed on.
Right. Right. So
that would destroy the market.
With all these factors in the backdrop, we've got borrowing on a home that hasn't been this cheap in a long, long time. 30-year debt is under 4.5%. A 15-year fixed rate mortgage in some instances is lower than 4%. Again, efficient market hypothesis. Does that take into account reality, or does it take into account simply a fabrication of reality? Is the hypothesis broken but still operative, and there's enough people in the marketplace who just don't recognize it as a broken model?
Well, David, I will say this. Talking to people who live in Vegas, they're saying that all those homes that have been built over the last couple of years are see-through homes. There's no one in them. They're sprawling everywhere. I mean, real estate in Las Vegas right now has become headline news nationwide.
Right. I drove to the McCarran Airport leaving Las Vegas just a few days ago, and I chatted with the cabbie, and he said that, you know, he had one house underwater significantly. The average across town is between $160,000 and $170,000. A UNLV study had looked at that, where $160,000 and $170,000 underwater is the average, okay? He was no different, significantly underwater, but he was able to buy two more homes recently in anticipation of this economic recovery.
So he's underwater. He's driving a cab for a living, which can't be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
And first he doubles down, and then he triples down
his
bet.
And he gets two more houses.
That's right. Well, it just makes sense if we're on the cusp of recovery. Now, while bold, I did have to venture the question about rentals. You know, is he going to support the mortgages with rentals? Mm-hmm. And he basically said, that's bit of an issue. There's a lot of real estate on the market. Rentals are not too strong, so he is shouldering all three mortgages. Again, as a caveat, I'm not meaning to be disparaging at all, but last time I checked, you know, mortgages on homes $150,000 to $200,000 a piece.
Times three.
Even in a best case scenario, 4.5%, you're looking at income requirements in excess of what you're going to be earning as a cabbie. So, you know, it seems that the sins of the past real estate boom have not been brought fully into the light, and the practices remain the same at the street level, at least with this guy who I drove to the airport with. I fear that these habits do extend beyond Vegas. What's practiced in Vegas does not stay in Vegas.
Right.
So if everyone is betting on a recovery, many a middle-class man or woman, cabbies included, are doubling down, tripling down. And that I see as a reason for concern that I don't see in the pricing of mortgage-backed paper or your average mortgage loan.
Okay, so that's real estate. But you did mention municipal bonds and treasuries earlier. What's your thought right now?
Well, the audience we had in Vegas probably saw me a little hot under the collar when it came to the issue of municipal bonds.
That might be an understatement, David.
I thought I stayed pretty well in control, but municipal bonds, according to a Moody's study done in February, this was on tax-free municipalities, state and local municipalities, according to them, face no challenges ahead.
So Moody's says, green light, go.
Yeah. So with peace in our hearts, let's see, calm returning to our nerves, we can know that Moody's, that venerable rating agency of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, CLOs, CDOs, and other AAA-rated, quote-unquote, paper of the sort of 2005 to 2007 vintage, they've provided us with much-needed peace of mind.
Well, they do that fairly often, don't they?
The nagging question, perhaps unimportant, I ask, why is the cost of insuring against default in Illinois and California, these are the tax-free municipals, why is it higher than the same default insurance for beleaguered Spain and Portugal?
Wow.
So Southern Europe is in the 213 to 265 basis point range in terms of credit default swaps. Southern California and Illinois are 300 to 332 basis points. It costs more.
Wait,
the assumption is that there is a higher default risk in these states than in the pigs.
Than in Spain and in Portugal. So it costs me more to insure debt that I own in Illinois, California, tax-free municipal
but
bonds.
But Moody's has said there is no problem.
Yeah.
There is no future, not just present tense problem, Kevin, but no future problem with AAA-rated paper.
I guess they need to tell the insurers or tell the market of the insurers of those CDOs that there is no problem.
And this is, again, going back to the efficient market hypothesis. If you look at the average price and yield of 20-year municipal bonds, you'll find that the Moody's conclusion is partially supported by the highest prices required to purchase munis, and the other side of that equation, the lowest yield in the last 30 years, coming in on average at about 3.48%.
Mm-hmm.
But someone's forgetting that there is an increase in services and a decrease in revenues at the same time, Kevin. In that is only a realistic state of affairs if you're the federal government and have access to a printing press.
Yeah.
This is the world where money is as free as the air we breathe. But, Kevin, that is not the case with municipalities. In other words, deficit spending at the state and municipal level does ultimately have consequences, real-world consequences, and the probability of default in those municipalities is not priced in one iota into the price. How efficient are these markets?
Okay, so I don't buy a municipal bond. Knowing the information you just shared with me, what about treasuries?
Well, with deflation in the wind or concerns about the solvency of other countries, strangely, more concern there than with concern over our own solvency, which is in itself an issue. Yields on treasuries have retrenched to about 4% on the long bond. 4% on the long bond. Thinking ahead, we have price stability in the municipal bond market. The mortgage market is just fine. We are betting, essentially, that those markets maintain a steady trajectory, a stable trajectory, if and only if the Fed comes in and is their support. The same attitude, we have the same attitude today about mortgage-backed securities and municipals as we did originally about agency paper. The whole market said, listen, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're as solid as the day is long. Why wouldn't I buy Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac paper? Why wouldn't I buy those bonds as opposed to treasuries? They yield a couple percent more, but it's the same as government paper. Right. The government's backing them.
They'll never let them fail.
Implicit to the yield in mortgage-backed security paper and municipal bond paper today is the activity of the federal government in bailout mode tomorrow. Hmm. That's what you have in the price. And there's a problem with that too, Kevin. There's a problem with that, too. The market is assuming that treasuries are the safest place to go. Mm-hmm. And while I appreciate the current bond market read of bad debt liquidation and the need for stability, which the market has determined can, in fact, be found in treasuries, I see the move as problematic by the market because bad debt is actually the moniker I would use for treasuries themselves, even more so in the event of what we just talked about, Kevin, munis and mortgage-backed securities being bailed out, taking our national debts to even greater heights, and the Fed balance sheet from its current level of $2.4 trillion, up from $800 billion just a year or so ago. I think you're going to have to expand that balance sheet to up to $5 trillion over the next 6 to 18 months to accommodate.
Okay, so how would you conclude that, David? I mean, we've seen billions of dollars. Now we see trillions of dollars. We even used the word quadrillion back for, you know, for derivatives at one time. I mean, what's your conclusion?
Kevin, that takes us back to 2009 when the Fed spent $1.25 trillion buying those mortgage-backed securities. It shows up on the balance sheet. That was their quantitative easing one. Now we've got quantitative easing two on the horizon, QE2. We should say, is set to sail. And I think, Kevin, with that, our last hope of a return to stable long-term growth. Hmm. You see, for us, balance sheet frailty and added debt ultimately cannot fix the problem we see in the financial market, which is in itself balance sheet frailty and too much debt. You can't solve the problem with the same issue. The problem doesn't solve the problem, and it certainly doesn't solve itself, and it's not going to be solved by the Mandarins in Washington. So what we have, Kevin, is over the next 6 to 12 months, the decision to support these markets versus liquidate the bad debts in the marketplace. And I think ultimately that will weigh heavily on the economy for decades to come.
So hence, no real recovery anytime soon.
The bad debts need to be liquidated. The sooner that happens, the sooner we can move towards recovery. It's not that recovery is not possible. It's just not possible when you're not willing to face the music. Mm-hmm. And the music needs to be faced. We've got bad debts. We've got too much debt. You know, going back to the municipal market, maybe I failed to mention that in the last 10 years, we have doubled the amount of money in the municipal market. It took us from 1945 to 2000 to accumulate $1.4 trillion in municipal bond obligations, and from 2000 to 2010 to go from 1.4 to 2.8. So not only is the market bloated, but it is priced for perfection at an average of 3.48%. Hmm. Again, I don't think that the market is as efficient, perhaps, as it used to be.
So the best of times, from an interest rate perspective, in the period of time that was the worst of times. So these really are the best of times and the worst of times, but the best of times is a lie.
Yeah, we're just overlooking the pertinent facts, which will be to the surprise and amazement of the marketplace, and perhaps its less seasoned participants. Mm-hmm. And the consternation I have, and maybe why I'm a little hot under the collar over that, is that Moody's is telling us that everything is going to be okay, just as Moody's told us that everything would be okay on the cusp. This goes back to 2006 and 2007, on the cusp of a major revolt in the credit markets.
Moody's is saying, pay attention to the coin swinging at the end of the chain. Just look into the coin.
So I think, frankly, Kevin, out of debt liquidation, we will see an inflation of the nastiest sort as we have Ben Bernanke pursue what he promised in 2002. What he said, if anyone hasn't read the script of that speech, you need to. He said, literally, in a fiat system, there's no need for deflation. In a fiat system, in other words, when you have a currency that is not backed by anything real and substantive, you can print as much money as you need to make deflation go away. He will be the master experimenter with inflation as a means to combat deflation. Right. Who wins, the market forces or a man with an ego on the line?
Mm-hmm. With a printing press, basically. So Ben Bernanke is basically saying, oh, you think it's deflation? Your currency's not worthless yet? We'll just print more.
And he has that flexibility. Now, to the questions, Kevin, that were asked, you know, here, there, and everywhere, whether it's Vegas, Zurich, New York, Jerusalem, a number of things that seem to be sort of repetitive themes. We do sort of a Q&A at the end of the year mm-hmm. where people send us questions. And the problem with those question and answer sessions is they're highly selective. We're getting the very best questions from the very most in tune people with the most interest in our program.
Right.
These were just more of questions that everyone was asking and still needed to be answered. So that's what we're going to do today, is look at a couple of those.
Well, David, I'll tell you, one of the main questions that I remember hearing over and over and over, and this is from people who sometimes were fairly sophisticated gold buyers. They would say, okay, so I have gold. What do I do with it now? How do I spend it? Who's going to buy it when it's time to sell? This is a question that's on the mind of a lot of gold owners right now as well.
Well, Kevin, as the price rises, it's also indicative of the audience growing.
Right.
So that's one thing to note, is that it's actually easier to sell in the context of a bull market because your audience is naturally growing. But you can also consider that free advertising for the asset that you already own. The price rise in and of itself is saying, hey, we're doing well. And you certainly see over course of time in any bull market a growing momentum trade, particularly as you get to a third and manic phase of a bull market, which we're still in sort of the second phase of accumulation by sophisticated and large money investors. But that third phase where the common man comes in, he's looking at the advertising of the last 5, 10, 15 years and the price action as it moves up. And just, he doesn't necessarily know the fundamental reasons why he's buying, but he sees the price action and says, yes, I'd love to participate in that growth.
Right.
There are a growing number of sophisticated investors and money managers that have come to terms with gold being in a bull market and other assets having too much risk and volatility for the reward they offer. And that is serving the demand side of the equation. That is a part of that growing audience. And the other issue, I think, Kevin, is that like any money, gold is a medium of exchange. You can either directly exchange it for some other asset, or you can indirectly change it for the currency of your choice, not necessarily dollars, and then determine what to do with it. And that seems to be the conundrum with a lot of people saying, if I'm opting out of dollars as my personal reserve currency and moving into gold, why at some point in the future would I exchange my reserve currency,
right,
gold, for a worthless currency,
dollars?
To go
back into cash, yeah.
And
why would you
do
that?
The point is, it's exchangeable into any currency in the world, including a future currency, U.S. currency, which may not be the greenback that we know.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, that's the indirect exchange, moving to currency, and then into some meaningful investment on the other side.
It could be real estate, it could be stocks, who knows at the time.
Or bypass the currency altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, the world has been made of transactions, if you go back 5,000 years, exchanging gold for something, whether it is land, farmland, productive capital, a share in business, a partnership with someone who has a business there in your hometown, an exchange for a rental property. I mean, the first time I saw this happen, I was about 8 years old, and I went with a young man who worked with us at the time. So this goes back to the 1970s. He worked with us at the time, and he bought a Trans Am, and he paid for it with dimes, silver dimes. And I'd never seen the exchange occur. And he explained to me, I'm giving him silver and he's giving me a car. And I know, this is what he said to me at the time. He said, I know he's getting the better part of the deal.
Right, right.
You know, because
you saw
his silver is going to continue to appreciate and my Trans Am is going to depreciate. Now, actually, in point of fact, that is a classic muscle car today. I don't have the greatest appreciation for muscle cars, but it actually has maintained some of its value.
Right, but not like silver. But, you know, Dave, just on that same question, I've heard you answer it numbers of times before, and that is, what makes us different, too, is we try to develop a relationship with people to give them an exit strategy so that when the question comes up, what do I do with it? We're going to be there. I mean, you've got answers at the time, depending on what the market is doing, as to where to exit your gold, how to exit, buy it back, and then what to go into.
Yeah. The exit strategy question was a big one, because I think a number of the people that we met with, particularly this conference, not a good measure of the general public. A lot more thinking people and a lot more people who already own gold. Mm-hmm. And the question, you know, where do I go from here? Going back to dollars is not the only option, which
right.
we just mentioned. You really have a twofold determination to make. One, how many ounces of gold constitute what we would call an intergenerational wealth transfer, where you wish to pass on from one generation to the next wealth in the form of metals.
Right.
Not to be sold wealth. Wealth that you pass on. Maybe it's like the antique furniture and you determine which kids get which pieces.
Right.
Or the painting, one of them really appreciates this particular style of work versus someone else not really caring that much.
That's the bottom of the triangle. That's the preservation mandate that stays there all the time.
It stays there all the time, and you determine how to make that a part of an intergenerational wealth plan. The second determination is trickier, but equally valuable. What productive assets should I exchange for my safeguarded wealth? In other words, as values of productive land, plants, capital infrastructure, as they become attractively priced relative to the gold that you own, what assets make the most sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Real estate, farmland, ranch land, stocks and bonds. What can provide you with an increase in either growth from that point forward, or income from that point forward, in the context of the normal risks and volatility really already being priced into the asset that you're interested in? In other words, the drop in pricing has already occurred. Now you are directly exchanging metals for something that has productive value.
Some productive value. Well, David, I'll mention just briefly McIlvany Wealth, because one of the questions that I had when I was there at the conference with you is, everyone lost money in their paper portfolios in 2008. I mean, everyone. There's just an assumption because of the news that everybody lost between 20 and 40% in the horrible year of 2008. When they find out that not everybody did, some people actually made money.
Right.
Paper portfolios made 6% or more. Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvany Weekly Commentary at McIlvany.com. That's McIlvany.com.
Our wealth management service, McIlvany Wealth Management, we started in a pretty tough year, 2008, and we did, after fees, come out on top between 4 and 6%, depending on the accounts. And there is a sensitivity to risk in the way that we look at asset management,
right.
And that's based on familiarity with every kind of risk coming from what we have spent decades doing, managing risk through precious metals portfolios. So on the paper asset side, with that sensitivity to risk, even in a recession, we've done pretty well. 2009, 2010 being no different. We just had our audited numbers done for the first 6 months of this year. Now, we're very satisfied.
That was part of the answer that helped with this next question. You know, people would come up to the booth and say, okay, what makes you guys different? I mean, there were five gold dealers at this conference that we were at. What makes you guys different than any other dealer?
I just want to say, going back to the MWM, that is one of the things. Our wealth management service is one of the things that sets us apart, because we see the end from the beginning. This is a bull market in metals today.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it's going to be a bull market in the metals forever.
Right.
Like most things, it cycles through in terms of being an asset class that is in favor and will eventually be an asset class that is out of favor. For insurance purposes, because I still have a lack of confidence in humanity,
right.
frankly, and certainly humanity as it resides in Washington, D.C., I think I'm going to hold a little bit of my gold forever.
Yeah, because paper IOUs actually are a representation of that humanity.
Right. But what I would say is that the wealth management service we started nearly 3 years ago is an anticipation of a reallocation. Not necessary today. Yeah. Now, we have a number of clients that have said, yes, but I still have paper assets and I'm interested in you doing something with them today. The larger issue for us today is the insurance component and maintaining a hedge in this environment. Kevin, what I read on the plane back from Las Vegas was a series of reports looking at the accumulated debt in this country and around the world that has yet to be liquidated in the context of this recession, We are not in a recovery.
So pay no attention to the debt behind the curtain.
Exactly. And it is ugly and it is catastrophic. And paying attention to the gold that you have on your balance sheet as the only balancing act between that and the excessive risk that exists in every other asset class that you own as an investor, you better be fixating on risk, or you're going to be fixating on very little else that's left in your portfolio. Again, on the MWM side, what makes us different and what makes us different as a gold company, two separate companies under the same group, McIlvenny Financial, we have a long-term strategy.
Yeah.
And this is based on a long-term intergenerational integrity.
And a skepticism towards the optimistic financial press where everybody's always thinking that we're turning out roses.
And equally, a skepticism towards the pessimism, which ultimately will dominate CNBC and CNNFN at just the wrong time.
A good point.
Focusing on both the errors of optimism and the errors of pessimism, seeing that people do maintain hope too long in an effort to maintain sanity. And then when they throw in the towel, it usually is at exactly the wrong time. But for us, Kevin, that intergenerational integrity has to do with handling clients' affairs, not just the clients that we have today, but their friends, family members, colleagues, the next generation for them, taking a long view to a client relationship. We don't deal in a transactional business the way that most people in our industry do without an eye to the future. With great care and concern, we look at what we do and take a very consultative approach to their financial needs and do so, again, not only with the current needs and the current financial circumstances in mind, but long-term financial planning in mind as well. So it's just perhaps a bigger picture. Whether it's a bigger picture as people have come to know us here on the weekly commentary covering Turkey last week,
right,
Switzerland. We do cover a lot on this program, but we have just as broad a picture in terms of our particular area of expertise there at ICA, our precious metals brokerage firm. 38 years of having done that.
Well, and speaking of the 38 years, I mean, one of the gentlemen that you sat down with who's nearing retirement age now was in medical school, and his father brought him to a conference. He said, "I heard your dad almost 40 years ago, and it changed the way our family does things, and I'm so thankful that I heard your dad speak at a conference." Some of these people, David, who came up and saw us, these are people we've known for 2, 3, maybe even almost 4 decades, and they're just so thankful that there's an intergenerational looking towards the horizon versus just the next sale.
Sure. That's the kind of relationship that we want to invite and, in fact, enjoy most. Kevin, there's a lot of other questions that related specifically to the metals. I'm thinking of one that came up a couple times there at the booth. Why buy gold when it's so high? I bought some at $300 an ounce, you know, and kind of the chest bows up a little bit, and with great confidence, I own the gold that I own at $300 an ounce.
Oh, yes, I saw this coming.
Yep.
But you ask if they have a third in gold.
No, because why would I want to change my cost basis and average up?
You're right.
And my question is, do you own enough ounces to constitute real wealth in your total asset
Or did
base?
You just buy at 300 and you're happy you did and you're scared to death to buy at 1200?
Yeah, so $1 million look and you have $10,000 in gold. Granted, you bought it at an exceptionally low price.
You bought it for $2,500 or $3,000, but yeah.
You still don't own enough.
Right.
Not $10,000 set against $1 million portfolio. But that's not insurance. That's not insurance. That's just a nod to I was early.
Yeah, I'll tell you, David, another question that came up, because one of the other things that makes us different is the Swiss placement programs. One of the questions that continued to come up was, this sounds intriguing, but why in the world would I want to have some of my gold in Switzerland?
That's a good question, Kevin. I want to go back to what constitutes too high a price. Is $1,200 too high? Is it too high? A lot of numbers get thrown around. If you adjust for inflation, you're looking at $2,800. What constitutes too high a price? You can look at the price of gold, and if you impute standard inflation, the CPI, we all know that it's understated, but take a conservative estimate and say, what's the inflation-adjusted price for gold using the government's own fudged numbers?
All right.
$2,300.
That's just the inflation-adjusted price.
Right. If you factor back in food and fuel and a few other components that have been stripped out of CPI, a more realistic inflation-adjusted price for gold, probably $2,800 to
$3,000. Right.
The issue is, Kevin, markets never do what they're supposed to do. They always either go too far, too high, or too far, too low. And it's because you're dealing with the extremes of human sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Confidence, greed on the one hand, fear, desperation on the other. And I think ultimately you're going to see gold go above its inflation-adjusted price by at least twice what it should be, mm-hmm. and ultimately what it can sustain. Mm-hmm. Gold can't sustain $5,000-$6,000, but it can touch it. It can get there. So when I look at a $1,200 price tag, I think we're still well below the inflation-adjusted price, and I would be buying with both fists at least up until we get to that point. And then just know that when you reach the inflation-adjusted price, above and beyond that, you're speculating on human sentiment driving it higher.
Or future inflation.
And in essence, in my opinion, playing the greater fool theory out in practice.
Right.
That is, you're assuming that someone else is going to come along and pay a significantly higher price, whether there's justification for it or not. That's an environment where you do need to let other people own a few of your ounces, which we were talking about earlier as an exit strategy.
Right, the exit strategy. So Switzerland.
Kevin, the rules are changing. And I think that you need to maintain autonomy. This is vital. If you go back to the speech that Alan Greenspan gave in his pre-self-deceived and corrupted days as head of the Federal Reserve, he was a gold bug. And he also was a student and friend of Ayn Rand. And his conclusion was that the state will chew you up and spit you out.
Mm-hmm.
And that a fiat money system will destroy individual wealth. This is Alan Greenspan. Will destroy individual savings and wealth every opportunity it gets. It's consistent through time. It does it. Period.
Right.
In recorded human history, a fiat money system has robbed individuals and savers of their wealth. And the only way to escape the state mechanism of wealth destruction is in gold.
That's
sure.
Alan Greenspan.
Of course, I'm paraphrasing. But why have some of your gold in Switzerland? Because the rules are changing. And the state mechanism here in the United States, there in Germany, everywhere around the world where they're dealing with problems, spending too much and not enough income, they're about to get desperate.
This brings up another question, Dave, because people said, oh yeah, well, physical gold in Switzerland, that sounds nice. I already own gold in Switzerland. Yeah, granted, it's on paper in Switzerland, but somebody will still pay, won't they?
Yeah, one of the most curious ways that people have been buying gold overseas, whether it's London or Zurich or New York, is to buy sort of a fraction of...
of a pile.
Right, or a fraction of an indivisible bar. You know, a 400-ounce good delivery bar, and you have your grams of gold
I've
in that bar.
I've got my 13 grams, yeah.
Right, which is very efficient, actually, in terms of purchasing it and storing it. But if you call for it, then there is transaction costs and the actual scramble for gold, if you will, to get you a format,
right,
which is, in fact, deliverable. Our approach has been get it in the format you want and own it in the format you want. And anytime you want that format, you've already got it. You already own it, and it's callable to you anytime or any place.
Right.
That seems to be, to us, a more intelligent approach. But clearly that fed over into another question dealing with ETFs.
Yeah.
Why would we own physical gold as opposed to ETF?
Which is exchange-traded funds.
And I would just say this, be very clear on the mandate that you've given that gold. If the mandate you've given to the gold in your portfolio is simply growth because you're following a growth trend, well, I think the ETF is adequate.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, it is an insurance mandate, then I would not confuse the accessibility of the ETF, the ease of trade there, with ultimately what you're trying to do, which is insure a part of your wealth and take it out of the system.
Yeah.
And put it in your control, where it is private, it is portable, it is personally controlled by you. I mean, these are the advantages of physical gold, and I don't think can be confused with an ETF, which is a great trading vehicle. In our wealth management service, we utilize it, but as a trading vehicle, not to be substituted, not to be confused with something that exists strictly as an insurance policy.
You know, David, switching to one of the reasons people are waiting right now, I heard this over and over, and granted, there were a lot of speakers right now calling for deflation. So I would hear this. This is the quote. I think there's going to be deflation before inflation, so I think I'll just wait to see what the price of gold does and buy later. What's your thought on that?
From 2007 to the present, we've had everything that would comprise deflation and deleveraging, and yet the price of gold has continued to move up anywhere from 30 to 50%. So the egg on face is in the deflation camp saying that gold does not do well in a deflation.
It's not that there's not deflation. It's that gold does well during a deflation.
And I think one clarification needs to be made. In a severe deleveraging, like what we had in the fall of 2008, and this is compatible with every instance of deleveraging in history, the first round of deflation, where people are scrambling for cash,
mm-hmm.
means that they do sell they're liquid assets. And gold does, like the baby, proverbially go out with the bathwater.
It drops temporarily very quickly.
Even in a severe, one of the worst credit shocks we've seen since the 1930s, gold still, even in that context, finished the year positive by 5%. Mm. So with an extreme sell-off, even then, you're dealing with a crisis of confidence, ultimately. And where does the money flow back to? Not into paper assets, what we would constitute as a paper promise to pay, but into physical metals where there is no promises, but 100% guarantees because you're in control of the asset.
David, so, we saw that 2 weeks ago when the stock market fell dramatically. It fell below 10,000. Gold dropped initially because there was a liquidity crisis, and gold is one of the most liquid currencies in the world, if not the most liquid currency in the world. But immediately, it recovered the next day and the next few days.
And something to add to that, Kevin, is that a U.S. deflation particularly does not constitute downward pressure for an asset class that has global appeal.
Mm.
If you assume, as many do, that gold goes down in a deflation, and here in the United States we're looking at a severe deflation, let's just grant them that argument.
Yeah.
You realize that the audience for gold is in Vietnam, it's in China, it's in India, it's in the Middle East.
It's in Europe. Look at the competition we have from the Europeans trying to get gold over here.
Normal supplies from Europe and from around the world coming into the U.S. have dried up.
Mm-hmm.
So the demand side globally, in spite of a deflationary trend here in the United States, has outstripped any supply that a U.S. investor putting that gold onto the market could potentially impact the market negatively. So I just don't see it. Early on, it goes down. We've established that. In a later stage of deflation, it rises. We saw a precursor of 2008, a severe deleveraging in 2010 or 11. I would expect the same.
You know, one of the things people have not experienced to any great degree, they did a little bit in October, November of 2008, but an actual inability to buy physical gold the way that they would like to buy it. So the whole idea of waiting until the inflation kicks in, you may not be able to buy what you need. David, just in wrapping up, there are a couple of things that just really warmed my heart. One of the things was a lot of the people stopped by, people I had never talked to before, and they say, we listen to your show every week. We really enjoy the weekly commentary. I think we ought to just thank the audience that's out there that we normally don't meet or normally don't talk to.
Yeah, and the opportunities that we have, whether it's San Francisco, New Orleans, whether we're doing our own private seminars, the invitation is always out there. And as often as we notify you, please consider yourself invited. We'd love to spend the personal time with you, getting to know you better. This is the nature of who we are and what we do. We're a family-owned group of companies. And we have the offensive coordinator. We have the defensive coordinator. The team, I think, is very well put together. We interact at the level of ideas here in this office on a continual basis, and as often as clients call in, we work with them.
Right.
As often as we go out, we get to meet people, and they can become a part of that family. That is certainly an invitation. We do things here on an intergenerational basis. It's a second-generation family business with an eye to serving clients on an intergenerational basis. And we've had that privilege now as we go out into the world and meet with our clients and figure that, yes, this is, you know, a 65-year-old who was introduced to us when he was 20 by his father.
Yeah.
Things like that happen to us on a regular basis where they've known us for a long time. They've followed Don's newsletters for 35, 40 years and have reconnected with us now that we've done the weekly commentary. I got to tell you, it's a very rich and rewarding experience for us to have the depth of connection we do to those people.
Well, and David, you don't have to have the name McIlvaney. Not all of us do, but a lot of the guys who work here started working here before they were either married or had kids, and now those kids have graduated from college, and so it is intergenerational.
True wealth for us is built intergenerationally, as are the principles necessary to its long-term maintenance. And we abide by the same set of ideas from one generation to the next, the guiding principles, if you will, which benefit and serve to the betterment of both our employees and our clients alike. Kevin, I think it boils down for us having a life well lived. In the context of business, in the context of analyzing information, in the context of meeting and greeting clients, and I certainly, at the end of these travels and being out and about, I'm glad to be home, but feel marvelously rewarded having rubbed shoulders with a lot of our clients out there. We get to work alongside you, and that's a privilege. We thank you for it.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You can find us at 800-525-9556 if you want a live voice at the end of the line. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.